sip on the go with a Starbucks Iced Shaken Espresso. Our signature roast, shaken with ice, then finished with a splash of milk. Customize it to match your style on the Starbucks app. Make today a good day.
Yo, yo, what up? Welcome back, everybody. My name is Peter Augustin. My show, The Houseless Podcast. Today's episode is a pretty special one. This is a follow-up or a part two to a conversation I had that was published well over a year ago with Peter Collins, a.k.a. Manifest, on episode 71. If you go way back, this is a kind of continuation of that. Let me bring you up to speed a little bit if you're totally unfamiliar with my guest. And I go pretty far back with him in regards to when I lived up in Humboldt County. I went to college at Humboldt State University. I lived in Arcata and was DJing a lot, performing a lot. And I met Pete just through shows, basically, and Panache Magazine. And I don't know, it goes back. It's a really small community up there, especially when I was there. And we ended up, he was a rapper, and I DJed for him, basically, on a bunch of shows locally around Humboldt County. And we did recorded a bunch of material together, and he would come to my sessions. You know, a lot of people don't know, I recorded many albums of me rhyming. And just for fun, mostly. So he would hang out at some of those sessions and so forth. Back in the late fall of 2006, Peacock kind of caught up in some pretty nefarious activity. And him, along with a couple of other people, decided that it was a wise decision to pull a caper on a casino in Northern California, and they got away with quite a large sum of money. Now, in episode 71 of The Houseless, which I encourage you to go back to and listen to if you have yet, Pete details this pretty thoroughly. So the whole episode of him and a few other people basically robbing a casino. And then, but I'm not doing this as a way to glorify that or glamorize it. It's a pretty dumb move, honestly. And he was caught and captured by the FBI and local authorities because he'd crossed state lines. And that's a little bit more about, that's where we left the last conversation at. And this episode is where we kind of pick it up. And from when he was captured to his time in county jail in Washington State, and just the harsh realities of this catching up to him, and catching up to him very quickly. So he was, you know, largely driven by an addiction that started with Oxycontins and escalated relatively quickly to heroin. And after several injuries and, you know, he was prescribed these oxys, and then that just like spiraled, like, and that's a story that's obviously very popular in this country. And so he detoxed in county jail. He's a hustler, so he was hustling in county jail as well. So we talk about a little bit of everything here, and I wanted to follow up with him. The last episode was recorded in Oakland, California. This one was recorded in Oakland, California. In fact, fun fact for the podcast listeners, I recorded this on the same day that I did my DAX interview. So I was up there. I actually also went to Hiro Day, all in the same day as this was recorded. It was a busy day for me, for sure. So it gives you a little more perspective on my recording schedule, too, when I'm traveling to do the podcast. And if this happens to be your first time listening, I encourage you to subscribe. It's available wherever you find podcasts. Shout out to the whole Pantheon team who now host my show. And you can get it at megaphone.fm. So it's on Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, Apple Podcasts. again, I feel like I'd be remiss not to say this again, in that I want, if you listen to this, you know, Pete's a very articulate speaker in a way, and I want you to look at this more as a cautionary tale to not get caught out there. No matter if you're in the throes of an addiction, especially an opioid one, or you're doing any kind of hard narcotics and alcohol or whatever it might be, that you can use the story that Pete tells here, that Manifest tells us, as a way to kind of know that you can spiral as far as that direction, where you rob an establishment for, you know, six figures in cash, make a mad dash and go on the run, and then you get caught, and then you go to jail, and then you sweat it out in hardcore detox in county jail where no one gives a fuck about you. And he was lucky enough to not have to be in jail for a very long time. So again, don't do that, and make the right decisions. And if you need help, you know, seek it out, you know? And Pete now is all in a much different place. This has happened obviously over a decade ago. So, and just because we have a long personal history and we're friends, he was generous enough to give his time to talk about this now ancient part of his life. He turned his life around. He's a functioning member of society and all that. So, and I appreciate him being as candid with me as he was too. So, and I like episodes like this, where it's not about music. It's just, we're getting so deep into someone's life story that you just can't replicate it. It's so unique to that human being. And that's kind of the reason why I always wanted to do this podcast as well. So anyway, without further ado, I'm going to go right into this conversation with me, Pete Collins, a.k.a. Manifest, on the House List. Go back, listen to episode 71. Scroll back, no matter where you listen to this, and go back and listen to that one, even if you need to before, because this is the part two. The last one ended kind of abruptly, so this is where we pick up. Either way, enjoy. I appreciate your time. Peace, y'all. Okay, so check it out. It's been over a year plus, I think, since last time I talked to you. Since we recorded this thing. And, you know, and since then, I've been wanting to try to get with you. And the way I left it with the last show was that eventually, one day, that we get back together and record this thing.
Yeah. And we've seen each other several times.
But, you know, it's not always easy to sit down and have a long conversation, a concentrated, focused conversation like this.
Totally.
So, you know, with your blessing, I'd love to be able to kind of pick up where we left off and close the book on this now very over 10-year-old story.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Put a bow on it, baby.
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah. So, I know that, like, you know, we left things with your story kind of at a very specific turning point, a pivotal point. Now, if you can jog your memory and bring yourself back to that place, then we can kind of guide ourselves through what seems like the was it 48 hours? It was a couple of months. There's definitely a few different phases of what happens to you after you are
raided.
Yeah.
Raided. So, yeah, I think where we left off was pretty much during the raid. The laser lights smashing through our little hideout, our safe house in Marysville, Washington, north of Seattle, maybe half an hour, where we thought we were all nice and cozy and safe. But again, I think I can reiterate, I sensed at that point that something was going on. We had been on the lam. Unbeknownst to me, we were on the lam because the investigation was underway for, I want to say, a month at least, actually, technically, it was all the way from like the day after Halloween, like November 1st or 2nd, when the heist occurred, and then all the way through December 15th. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so basically, I'm sitting there after the bust, cuffed. We go through the thing with her dad shows up, which was a shocker, and you know, he threatens me. So they put me in the cop car. They put her in the cop car, my co-defendant and co-dependent, as it were. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the, that's right. And then I'm in the Marysville substation. They count the money. They tell me what's there. They tell me how it's very close, or, you know, approximately the same amount as that was stolen. And then they even say it's the same bands were used to separate these stacks of bills. The bands were fucking like every other band of putting every other stack of money among the whole nation. It's the same shit, but they're like trying to say we've got you dead to right because these rubber bands are used in the casino.
Yeah.
And again, like, they were as fucking generic as any freaking napkin or any paper cup.
But so they're trying to play that card on.
Yeah, they were like, we got you. I said, you don't have anything. There's nothing. I got some fucking money that I've been saving.
And they want that dead to right situation to go down too, to kind of wrap it up.
Yeah, because they want an admission. That's all they want. They want me to say, oh shit, the jig is up. You got me. The whole time I'm like, what the fuck am I? What did you guys raid me for? Why am I locked up? Are you arresting me? And they couldn't even arrest me for all those hours, even though I was obviously under arrest. But I wasn't trying to, you know, fight too crazily because, you know, you can hastily say something that may incriminate yourself. So really, I should have never said a word. But me being me, a little standoffish at times, downright confrontational, I was holding my ground as an innocent guy that's walking around, you know, a couple hundred racks under my bed at miscellaneous places. But it came down to, they did have the black tar, well, the heroin, and they had the, and I think it was under a half ounce, about a half ounce at that point. But if I recall, I had about like 2 ounces when I left Humboldt. Personal use only. Quite exorbitant.
And that's a lot. But I mean, I guess it's important to make that point because it's not like you were doing anything else with it.
No, I've never sold any of it. It was literally all fucking for use, and we used it prolifically, quite luckily too, because, you know, when you're messing with those types of amounts and you're kind of still new to it, you know, fortunately at that point, fentanyl wasn't part of this whole cutting that you hear about now, and there wasn't overdoses rampant across the country like there are now. It was just good, clean, quality, genuine opiate, you know, derived heroin. Yeah. So I also had the guns, which I don't know if I mentioned last time. One thing I'll never forget is when I was driving away, or getting driven away in the cop car, I remember one of the big federal guys was talking to the main detective, and one of the guys said, he said, okay, so you got the firearms? And the detective said, yeah, we got that little, like, it was like a double style, like 22 revolver, which means it had long range bullet capability, or long range shells for, like, you know, hunting, like sniper style, even though it's 22. And then we had, and then there was also the Magnum, which is like, you know, for like short range blowing big holes into stuff. And that's kind of nice for a cheesy little pea shooter 22. Right. Anyway, it was an antique. And so I heard him say, yeah, we got that we're 22. And then we also got that sawed off, that 12 gauge. And I remember specifically, he's like, this is gangster 101, man. Like, they thought they had the fucking kingpin with this fucking cheesy ass. I think it was like a fucking Big Five, like duck shooter. It was just a pathetic, like, and I cut it off, obviously, because that's what you do. You know, I didn't need a fucking goddamn long fucking barrel rifle toting around. So I just remember that gangster 101. He was like, fucking, yeah, we got this fucking G. Yeah. Pathetic. But anyway, so I'm at the substation. And they say, okay, we're booking you. And I'm in on drugs and guns, which is no, you know, lighthearted matter. I don't care what state. Yeah. And so it was a state case. So I was like, wow, there's a little potential hope. There might be light at the end of this tunnel somehow, some way. Although deep inside, I know they got me pretty much dead to right, for all intents and purposes. So I'm locked up, and they know I was on, you know, heroin. So, and as well as 80 milligram OxyContins that I was snorting. That's kind
of pretty high dose.
Snorting?
Yeah. We didn't mention that. Yeah, well, I had taken them for like a fractured back that they wanted to, the surgeons wanted to cut into me several times in the years prior from several different injuries, one of which is a football accident. And I had three different car accidents in my life that put me through windshields, knees busting through glove boxes and whatnot. But yeah, so I've had a fair amount of body traumatic, you know, carnage. So anyway, yeah, I was on the, that's how it started. Just like the whole tale of American, you know, like, you know, the whole locker room, you know, heroin or whatever. It's like the OxyContins got me on that. I started selling them because I could make $5,000 a bottle of fucking Oxy 80s. And I was buying them with an insurance through AAA that gave me another deal. So it was like $2 a pill and I was selling it for $80 a pill, upwards of 80. A lot of times I'd sell the whole bottle like all at once, $40 a pill. So I don't know if that was like 3,000. But anyway, yeah, every couple of weeks, every month, that was a nice little paycheck subsidized by our wonderful Western civilization medical pharmaceutical company. But that's neither here nor there. What?
Yeah, and this is, that's kind of a sidebar. I mean, but yeah. I think that does, I guess, play into why you got where you were.
Heroin. Yeah, that's exactly why. Because I started selling them all, and then all of a sudden I had a back spasm again. At some point, it seized. I was incapacitated. I started eating up all the pills. And then at one point, someone had a pill at some place in Eureka, and I snorted it because he couldn't give a whole pill to me. My back was gone, and so I snorted it. And literally that day, like so many thousands of other kids, you know, you start snorting that shit and it's just, that's it. That's like better than heroin. It's cleaner, it's more smooth, it's a fucking warm, fuzzy, you don't have a pain in the world, not mentally, emotionally, and definitely not physically. You know, you could look back at the, you know, the opium fucking era of China thousands of years ago.
Silk Road.
Yeah, it's like there, that's a real thing, and I can't even, you know, be mad at him. I get it. So I'm hooked on oxys, and it turns out I run out of that. What do you get? You get the fucking next best thing, heroin. It's like a fraction of the cost, and there it is. You got your, you know, garden variety fucking heroin addict junkie smack fucking sick man.
So what was your, looking back now, because obviously that was a long time ago and you've changed like in many, many ways, like just like how do you view that period of time, like where, like, I mean, you must have had some close calls too, or just like
overdosing, or like,
or just like this, the day-to-day, like getting around being like, you know, a functioning addict. Yeah. You know, like,
well, I mean, initially my, I guess my my retrospect has revealed, I mean, being an artist.
Was it even an addiction thing? I don't want to be as presumptuous to even say that. I'm sorry. But.
Well, no. And that's weird. That's a pigeonhole that I've always had problems with, addiction, being dependent, and this and that. I will fully admit, yeah, that there was two points where I realized that the enjoyment and the recreational use of, and even previous medical necessity of opiates was required for me. I could actually function as a, you know, a damn near invalid, like my back. So I was so incapacitated with pain. There was times in my life when I was teaching school, my back would go out. I couldn't even move around in my bed. I could definitely not get up to go to the restroom in the middle of the night because at my back, I would fall. And I was like, it was like two ice picks jammed into your spinal column. And
damn.
I don't know. I don't care how many gunshots and how many fucking car accidents you get in. That's a pain that fucking demobilizes you. So I'd have to like piss in a freaking milk jug next to my bed.
Yeah, because you couldn't get out of bed.
Couldn't get out of bed. Right. It was just so it was like in the hospital. I learned that trick in the hospital, you know, when you're in the ICU and you are. And you got to piss, and you're stuck there. You're pissing in a jug. So,
right.
So when I had to, and I didn't want to piss my bed, and you know, I was fresh out of Depends.
yeah, I understand.
Yeah,
yeah. I've been laid up in the hospital. I know, I've had all the tubes inside of my body.
Man, you know, that's no fun gig, bro. That's
no, I wouldn't classify it under the fun part of life.
Yeah, no, that's it, on the opposite end of the spectrum, as they say. So yeah, but like really just in generally speaking, yeah, I will coincide what you're saying. I was at this time quite hooked on the drugs because my vision was cloudy, my planning, my plotting, my overzealous bravado, which put me into doing this job. I think I may have alluded to previously on the first half of this tale. I was planning to do this a year later. I had this other job, which I, you know, forget what it was. Okay. But
I
was going to do, I flipped the script. I was influenced by my two co-codies that they were feeling a little amped, wanted to get some cold hard cash quick. I, you know, agreed because money's money, whichever job. But I knew that the casino was going to take a lot more planning and a lot more meticulous, methodical process to undergo and further pull off. But the drugs clearly got into my head and it made me go, you know what? I'm a fucking pro. I've been doing this shit for long time. I'll just, you know, I didn't say I'd wing it, but I had the plan, I had the strategy, everything set, the disguise, the fucking layout, the logistics, but I didn't properly go over the plan with the two, I guess you would call it novices, the two, you know, and so because I didn't run through shit perfectly with them, it's consequently the few mistakes that were revealed, which turned into full evidence, were the cause of our demise and subsequent arrest and incarceration.
Okay.
So
and that came to be revealed like when you were in Maryville? Or?
The addiction stuff or the...
Well, the evidence.
Evidence. Yeah, okay. Well, that's... So the feds are thorough. They do investigations like no one's business. No one on the planet is more thorough with gaining evidence, manufacturing evidence, or... maybe suspecting evidence and then being able to cultivate a plan or a route that leads to the alleged concrete evidence. I know this is a bit abstract, but that's what an indictment is, okay? An indictment is they write the story, they write the tale. In my case, it was a 27-page indictment that drops on you that you're given. And before your, you know, sentence, or before your trial begins. So that indictment, for all intents and purposes, is game tight. It's locked and loaded, and it's ironclad. You're not going to be able to win against whatever indictment they have, because that's how the math of this works. It's a science. So you can't win. That's why they have a 99.9% success rate, because if you read top to bottom in indictment, it's all the evidence is presented and all the facts and all the stats and all the figures. It all leads up to guilt, period. So, but the problem with an indictment is that it's half of it, if not more, is speculation. It's their assumptions. It's their presumptions, the feds, that is, and the investigators. And then they build on each of those thoughts and those processes, and then they gather and they get, and then again, they formulate certain routes that will lead to that. So it's a fuck system, and it's genius on their part, but really it's systematically, like, fucking setting up. And, you know, people might just laugh at this, but we know what's up. It's just real. There's no joke about it, and they do great because of the government. So, but to reel it in here, back to... they knew they couldn't arrest me. If they had me dead right, they would have arrested me on the spot for the heist.
Yeah.
Clearly. But what are they arresting me for? They have a manhunt across three states, and they arrest me for drugs and guns? Now, think about that. What the hell does that even fucking accomplish? Drugs and guns? So what do? I get arrested. I'm put in there on drugs and gun charge. I'm going to fucking bail out. Of course. Because there's no federal anything. It's like I'm not there for fucking felonies, five felonies, because I never got this indictment yet. I got charged. So what do? Within like a couple of days, they bailed my gal out. Within 24 hours, my gal was able to get bailed out by her folks who put a house up and got her out. She had no priors. She had nothing. So, I mean, they basically were like, they didn't even have to put the house up then. They just bailed her out with like 10 G's. Right. Yeah, that comes later when the indictment fucking is dropped. So she gets out right away. At this point, I have no knowledge on the inside man, Mr. Security, head of security, who was in charge of the cameras and the auto locks. So he, at this point, I'm not sure. I do know that he was taken in for questioning right after the actual job was completed. And that was obviously a bad sign that I didn't have any of that information. In fact, I wasn't privy to that until far later, which is also part of this, the grand picture of why things fell apart and unraveled. Mm-hmm. Communication broke down. So, but me in jail, I was able to contact my gal, and say, I need to get bailed out as soon as humanly possible. And so for drugs and guns, I'm thinking it was, I want to say it was like $50,000, I think. So it was like, no, it wasn't even that much. It was peddly. It was like 10 G's. Because I remember I was using the security deposit for that McKinleyville courthouse where me and my gal were at. I may have alluded to that earlier. We were living in a house in McKinleyville, and that's when we had the general delivery address in McKinleyville. That was the last spot we were living up to the day of the heist, because we got the storage literally the block right down the block from the house. So we had that security deposit literally in the mail, and I was able to get her to get a direct line on it. I don't know, there was no Venmo then, but it was like we got cash, I think, at Western Union, ironically, because that was part of the evidence later on in the indictment that I sent wire fraud cash to my other co-defendant. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we get the check. I mean, we get the cash. She gets a G, or $1,500, and that's why it was $15,000 bail. So she gets $1,500. It was perfect, actually, or maybe $12 or $13 and change. But the thing is, she got the bail money, and so I'm in the process of bail. They got the bail bondsman. We had the bond granted, meaning that bail bondsman took care of it with the jail. So at this point, it's weird because I'm arrested by federal government, but technically, my case was a city case.
Or, yeah, you know, that's what it sounded like.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why I immediately started smelling. That's why I said I've got to get out and bailed immediately, because I felt there was a loophole in here, because it just wasn't adding up. They didn't arrest me. They had this whole, you know, thing about me and holding me and trying to get me to admit to something that I, you know, clearly had nothing to do with. Mm-hmm. Wink, wink. And so as I was being processed, and I was in that jail for actually, it was a couple of weeks. It wasn't fast. I went through a detox. So when I got...
How did that go?
Well, that was the first time I ever realized, oh, this is clearly a problem. Yeah. That's when I...
Pretty deep in your system, I imagine.
So bad. I was on such a high tolerance. I was consuming grams a day, maybe 2 grams personally, smoking, and then like, you know, anywhere from like 2 to fucking 6 Oxycontins, 80s. I mean... You do the math on that, you know, that could kill an elephant within, you know, doing all that within a couple of hours. But like I said, it was like a 24-hour thing. Mixing those two, that's just a fucking salad of demise, straight chemical, the strongest of, you know, slowing down, downing, you know, heart rate and blood. It's just down to a fucking whisper of a pulse. Anyway, wow. That's where I was at. So when I get in jail, I immediately, they actually put me in the medical ward straight out the gate because they knew I was arrested on heroin. They asked me, I clearly said, yeah, I've been doing smack. I'm on that junk. And they're like, okay, so they put me in. They're like, well, you're probably going to detox. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I don't think so. Well, harsh realities, because the next 7 days were probably the most painful, most nightmarish, most sickly, torturous, self-contained days of my life that I can recall, other than, you know, the weeks after getting shot and a couple other car accidents where I was ICU. but like,
so
yeah,
what are the what are the symptoms of that?
So
know,
I was
detoxing in jail. I mean, you're throwing up, obviously, cold sweats.
Not even, I didn't ever throw up at all. Okay. Within 24 hours, the pains start, the aches and pains, much like, you know, if you fall out of, you know, a couple story building and you're laying there and everything's bruised. You can't move. The crickling, crackling of every joint. It feels like you've been rusted. You need, like the Tin Man, you need someone to oil the joints.
Oh, wow.
But you're fucking squeaking, and with every move, you're getting stiffer and more fucking atrophied. And then the sweats are immediately, every pore of your body is just grotesque cold sweat, like clammy, clam fucking sticky. But the whole time, your head is like pounding, and you're fucking like having pressure in your skull like you've never known, like a horrific type of like, I don't know, you know, that old torture chamber, like that Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
It's all those spikes are being crushed and pressed into every part of your cellular structure while your head is trying to explode outward and liberate, you know, the brain matter on the fucking four walls. But
wow, man.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's, you know, this is nice, I can talk about it now. Back then, it was just moaning and groaning. And so it was that profound, the pain and the anguish. I couldn't even go into the shower. I couldn't walk across the fucking 10, 15 feet to the shower in the medical ward. They would, this is the real problem. It was basically torture. They know this is going on. And sure, if it's drugs, whatever, yeah, it's illegal. But you know what? Even people that are on Oxycontins and morphine and cancer victims, and traumatic war wounded fucking amputees, these guys are hooked on opiates, you know, sanctioned by our wonderful system here, and yet they go through detox. So if it was one of those and I was like a war hero or whatever it was, I would have, they would detox me with drugs, and maybe not like opiates, but they would detox you with the parallel relaxers and the inhibitors that are going to keep you from shaking violently and ultimately having a fucking heart attack, which is a high risk when you go from all that, just like alcohol. If you fucking been drinking and sopping it up for fucking years and you cut cold turkey, you clearly can have seizures. It's a documented fact. Your body can't take such a swing from so dirty to so clean detox, and that's all it is all the garbage coming out of every pore, and it's so, it's just hell on earth. Everything you see in the movies, of the shakes and the jittering, you know, i.e. Nick Nolte in Leaving Las Vegas. I mean, he did spot on job, and that was just alcohol. When you got the heroin thing, it's nightmare. And
what was that other movie, Rush? That was
remember
that? Yeah, they were kind of the junkie couple.
Was Luigi's Yama on that?
No, that was, you might be thinking of Blow. Rush was with
Rush.
Who's the main actor in that?
Was Rush the Speed Freaks, right?
I need to go on the IMDb after this.
Perfect. No, but anyway. Now that you mention that, Trainspotting comes to mind, which I'm pretty sure there's a clear detox rendering in that picture, a nice little snippet of memories.
So do you ever find yourself, like, when did you get to the other end of that? Was it eventually, like, while you were there, or?
Well, just because I'm being honest and candid, and
please keep it 100 with me.
Well, it got so bad in those 7 days that I was awaiting. I couldn't even get to the visiting, so there was no contact. I was virtually like dead man lying there. There was several times over that course of a week that, like, it was a rotating door, and I was in a room with four plastic, kind of like, they're like rafts. They were kind of like kayaks, but in each, and they were beds, plastic beds. that were mobile or, you know, portable. And so in each of the four corners of the room, there was four motherfuckers that were detoxing.
Oh, my God.
And every one of them was going through their own fucking misery and hell on whatever way. Some guys were puking all over the fucking floor and walls. You smell that. There was guys that were shaking and jittering in basic seizure convulsions. Other guys were moaning and screaming and clawing at his face. Oh, I can see it like this. A different time on one of the rotations, the guy, he had to pull his pants down and lay on his fucking stomach because he had an abscess on his fucking ass cheek from shooting up so many times that it was like the size of a rotten grapefruit coming off of his fucking ass. And I just was like, dude, is that shit going to explode? And he was just crying and crying. And this guy was like a 200-pound fucking white dude that was just not someone that you'd think is like a whimper, with tears. But it was fucking hell. And you couldn't block it out. You could put your fingers in your ears, but you just feel the grim vibe. So there was a time, maybe after the fourth or fifth day, it got so grim. Like, I was dropping and dropping. They didn't give you anything. The one thing they would give you for the first, 72, 96 hours was fucking electrolytes, which basically was Gatorade, I think, or some derivative of that, homemade, county issue. And that didn't do shit. It tried to taste good. And they were like, that's all you need to prevent from, fatality. So it was I swear to God, it was a fucking joke. And so it got so bad. The days seemed like months. And the hours seemed like weeks. And I'm talking about every minute that would go by, the tick. And then the talk was a second. I couldn't take it. I started thinking of ways to, quiet this moment and end this misery. And it was weakness. It was just, I had never felt that through all the pain and actual physicality of trauma that I've been through. This, again, was unparalleled, which is what's so sad and crazy about this, because people find themselves in this because addiction is a disease, and there's not a lot of help, and we're fed these fucking cocktails of drugs that are totally legal and prescribed, and yet then this kind of stuff happens. So so I was thinking of ways, and I devised a couple of plans, and I won't go into much detail, but it definitely was the first time in my existence that I was thinking to close the book and the final chapter, epilogue, done deal, signed, sealed, delivered. I was ready. I just wanted darkness and peace and no idea of what would happen after that, but I knew that it would have to be no worse than what I had experienced for those many days. And I didn't follow through with any of those potential plans, obviously.
Oh, yes, thankfully.
And thank you. And I'm glad, because I did turn the corner. I was able to get into the showers in the next couple of days. And a hot shower, once the detox, after about 96 hours, I'd say 5 to 6 days of torture tremors, I finally was able to climb across the hall into the shower with the help of a chair that I was sitting on in the hot shower. And when I put the boiling hot water on and just sat there, that was the first solace that was restored in those 7 days since the crazy raid, the stress, the anguish, the fucking unknown, the pain. So, and then those hot showers were everything. I waited 24 hours to just get that 20 minutes in the hot shower. And then I started eating solid food.
What kind of food they give you?
Fucking crap. I don't even remember, to be perfectly honest. I'm sure it was just county food, county jail food, which is basically just fatty, starchy, salty, fake protein type of meat, stewish, and carbs of fucking goo. It's just, and that was the Thanksgiving feast. it only got worse when it was just day-to-day meals. I'm not shitting. Anyone that's been in county can attest to that. Yeah. I mean, you'd be happy, to get a sack lunch for a breakfast, which is typical on a sidebar here. 4 a.m., you wake up in most counties, in California counties across the board. You wake up, and several of them in intake, at least in medical, you'll get a sack lunch, which is basically usually a very stale, if not somewhat mildewy, wheat bread sandwich with kind of a like a spackle type of peanut butter flavored entity, kind of stirred up with some jelly colored paste, and that's your PB&J. And you get a rotten or somewhat it's basically like a mildewy orange that didn't really have the composure of like a sphere. It was kind of like a lump of citrusy appearing stuff, and that was fruit. And that could have been either an apple, an orange, or I don't know, something else, an oversized rotten grape. But there also was maybe a cookie or a bag with like three half tortilla chips. So anyway, and so you get two of those bags. You get that one for breakfast, and you'd save one for like 3 hours later, which is your lunch. And then for dinner, you get the hot meal, which again was take everything I just said and microwave it for like 5 minutes and let it like, you know, morph into something even different and more undelicious. Highly nutritious, support accordingly. Yeah, because
and the commissary. What's the deal with the commissary?
Commissaries are great. Yeah, candy? It's all junk food. It's all crap. It's all overpriced. The biggest travesty of commissary in our great state would be the top ramen. You'd get one of those top ramens that we all know and love, and we buy for 15 cents at you know whatever Safeway, Lucky, Pay and Pack and Save Mart or whatever you shop.
Yeah, right.
And 15 cents, but now I'm sure it's a whopping inflated 25 cents for one of those. Well, in our wonderful fucking institutions, you can get for the wonderful, beautiful, inflated low price of like $3.25 for a single 1.5 ounce fucking top ramen, which again, stale and crumbled up inside its little package. So yeah, that's an inflation of you know, offhand, I don't know how many 300% or you know, but yeah, it's not a deal. But you know, you're desperate in there, you're gonna fucking buy a case of them anytime you can. So commissaries, you get sugar by way of Kool-Aid, you can get your like loaf, smoked loaf of whatever kind of tube meats.
Really?
Yeah, and whizzy cheese type squirt things, which are kind of popular, and every kind of chip, every kind of candy bar. Which then you could get you know, packs of rice. You could get like one popular thing that I would always get is like the pork rinds. Mm-hmm. And one thing I learned how to make, which was really good. I mean, the typical thing is just spread. You make a spread, quote unquote spread. What that is basically a hodgepodge compiling of all different inmates. We get together, we fucking have a table. You throw all kinds of ingredients basically in the pot, and then the chef Boyardee, whoever it chooses to be, or Betty Crocker, of course, they mix it all up and throw boiling water in a pot, and like I said, take all the ingredients, you know, candy bars notwithstanding, add the water, mush it up, and let it reconstitute, and you basically lay it flat and press it onto a big piece of plastic or foil or, you know, granted you have the luxury of any of those tools, and then you let it dry. Or not, you kind of let it solidify, and then you chop it up with, you know, like a piece of plastic bowl or cup, and then you like dish it out. And I mean, that's like, that's a treat. Yeah, and that's like the midnight snack, because it, as I was talking about, it's 4 a.m. for the typical breakfast, then it's 11 a.m., 10 or 11 a.m. would be lunchtime. At the latest I've ever seen a lunch was like noon, and that just doesn't happen because that's already like swing shifts are already going. They want you done and down with dinner before 4 o'clock. There's no 5 o'clock dinner. So if you just do the math real quick, I mean, that's like a 12 hours with no food coming from the county. And again, those are being a little liberal, like with those estimates. I mean, it's usually like 4 a.m. breakfast and like 10 o'clock, I remember. 6 hours later, you have lunch. And then like 2 p.m. was being dinner. Yeah, it would be like 2 p.m. Like a normal to late lunch would be your last meal. And then a midnight snack is your first meal. And then you're done. 12 to 14 hours, you're food free. So you have to have commissary to get to your point.
Yeah,
and and you have to stock it up. You have to save it. But me being me, I was always wonderfully capable of, you know, procuring all the items I needed, wanted, desired out of playing poker, you know, winning. And then, of course, I'd use my artistic skills to, like, make nice little calligraphy, like, artist renderings of, like, my pseudo Hallmark cards, you know, uh-huh. and just basically script. I would write people's poems for them. I would write poems and sell them. And you'd get an item or two for every little thing you did.
Oh, wow.
So you could stack up 20 items in an afternoon or a 24-hour session, and that's, like, that's bank. It's like hundreds of dollars, because you buy something for like a dollar on commissary, and usually it goes across the board, like the value stays the same.
Uh-huh.
But sometimes you get $4 or $5 for doing some awesome piece. Way early in juvenile hall, I did, you know, a couple tattoos on guys with like a fucking safety pin, a piece of thread wrapped around,
and some stick and poke.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, and then between that, and then my ultimate nut was the moneymaker, the big Pruno, the wine, the jailhouse fucking brew.
And you did that?
Yeah, I've had a lot of experience with like home brews, like in college. All kinds of friends are doing that. And ultimately, I have, you know, some real experience with vineyards and winery and winemaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from a young age, some of my first memories in Humboldt County were rolling up my overalls in the front of my uncle's barn house, farmhouse that is, and stomping on grapes inside a clawtooth bathtub out there in the lawn, and just watching all that purple dribble into a 5-gallon drum, and doing that for like a whole day, and just the legs for weeks, it seemed, were like purple, like absolutely dark lavender skin, because just thousands of, you know, grapes. And so that was the beginning of like my winemaking experience. Not that I ever was a winemaker, but I got top to bottom, got to see everything from picking grapes to the actual science behind it, the fermenting, the bottling, and then of course the distribution, you know, manufacturing. It's a wonderful science. It's a great craft to know, and I was able to apply a few of those little things in, you know, incarcerated. And it's really simple. Like, it's a joke how simple it is to make like potable fucking spirits. I mean, all you need is a couple of oranges or apples and some sugar.
And
that's it.
And you put it what, in the toilet or something?
There's many ways to do it. I wouldn't do that just because it's a toilet. Yeah. But I would do it basically in a jug. You can buy several size jugs, like, you know, those giant Tupperwares to put your books and your shoes and this and that. So what you need is a bag, a thick plastic bag, which are ample. Everywhere, garbage bags there. You need hot water, which most jails will offer you. All jails I've been into would offer you hot boiling water and to make your foods and your drinks and your coffees, which, by the way, coffee was a huge commodity. That was one of the biggest commissary buy and sellers because of obvious reasons.
Sure.
Yeah, $3 a bag of coffee, and it was that freeze-dried shit, and it was so good. You just get cracked out from that for work for like 8 hours straight,
right,
whatever job you happen to have or manufacture. So, yeah, and then basically you boil up like in a bag, you crush up the fucking juice with, whether it is lemons. You could sometimes procure lemons from like the pod, whatever they call them, I call them lackeys, but you know, the trustees.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the cell, the inmates that are working for the COs, and they're the ones that are like the worker bees that give us the stuff, that give us the magazines, they trade stuff between cells, food, you know, and they're out of their cells all day long if you're in a pod. Like, if you're in a dormitory setting, which also I am in, like Humboldt County is, you know, known for that, in the county jail, where it's all dormitories essentially, which means you got like, you know, 20, 30, 40 beds in one big gigantic cell or room,
right,
or dorm. And anyway, so, and then you don't need too much work from like a trustee, because you have access to hot water, you have access to the sinks and the bathrooms and the showers and the library right there. Anyway, so to make the juice, you fucking you really need a kicker, which means like a piece of bread or a piece of mushy fruit that's already been fermented and already has gone through the stage of fermentation, which is, you know, sugar turning into, you know, alcohol essentially. And so it's nice to have a kicker. Some yeast, of course, is what kickstarts the whole process from turning fruit and juice and sugar into liquor. Mm-hmm. And that's it. So you boil it over and over. You have the bag of goods, and then you have another bag that's enclosed in, and you just keep pouring hot water, boil it day after day. You got to let it burp or else it'll explode just like a soda pop or a champagne bottle.
Yeah.
So every day you got to let out, because when it's fermenting, the stronger the shit is and the hotter it gets and the hotter you're cooking it, the bigger the giant bag gets. And that's why it's great to have garbage bags, because if you had like a sandwich bag, it's impossible. It would blow up before you even barely zipped it shut. So a big bag means you can make a big batch. And I would have, fortunately, it got easy later on in the 2000s when like soda machines were implemented and put into all jails. So you get a 20-ounce bottle of soda, and then that was your all-contained bottling, you know, manufacturing plant, like assembly line. I'd have like 30 or 40 bottles that I'd save, and you hide those, you know, under your mattress. You hide them in a, you know, makeshift pillow. Mm-hmm. Or you can, it's plenty of ways. You can hide them out in the main pod area, and if you're just, you know, careful enough. So you would fill all those up, and then you keep cooking those, and you just undo the tops now and then. In 11 months that I ended up being in Oakland, so I just fast forward, you know. And that was the main amount of time that I was in jail awaiting trial. So I got caught like 11 times in a year. It was, I'm sorry, 11 times I got caught making Pruno inside of the year and a day that I was sentenced.
Okay.
So it's a little bit of a tale between that and where I started this little detour of it. And then the final time, 11th time, I actually got thrown in the hole for making Pruno. So again, but making that jailhouse wine, I made thousands of dollars. I mean, The fucking hit. Yeah, it's like I was the local bar. I literally was the bartender, dude. I was like the fucking, it's just gold. I mean, you can't even express, it's hard to, you know, explain like how much power having liquor is incarcerated, because sure, it's the best escape. It just makes everybody's happy. You can laugh just out of silly, numb brain feelings, and whereas 10 minutes before, you're ready to strangle somebody and fucking hang them for the top deck or take a nosedive yourself. And then you get them drunk, and shit's fucking jolly. Everything's happy. And so I was slinging shit. You know, usually it would take like an average, like novice, like a week to make some shit. But I was able to get my time frame down to like definitely one and sometimes two batches in a week, like a 7-day period. And that's,
and what's a batch? It's just one bottle?
No, like 30 or 40 bottles.
Wow.
30 or 40. So that would be several gallons.
And then you sling them, or?
Yeah, just sling them. I was slinging them. I was getting like fucking. And so this one guy right next to me, who came in a couple months after I arrived, he in the cell next to me, he had been shot, I think, 9 or 13 times here in Oakland. And so he came in. He was a wreck. He was like, you know, he was had holes all over his fucking body, wow, bandages. So over the next couple of months, I realized he was getting the best narcotics that, you know, county jail could buy. And they were, I mean, he was on relaxers and opiates and painkillers. So we became, you know,
buds,
thick as thieves. Yeah, fast friends. And I had what he needed and he had what I wanted, and we found all that out by playing cards together, you know. When he first became conscious and got the jaw unwired, I think, from some of the shrapnel bullets, then jeez, we started. When I look at what happened to me, and then I look at guys that I was in there with, a fucking serial killer that like took out several women like in the Diamond District or Fruitvale, like around the time of 06 when this all transpired. I mean, this guy is fucking in the paper, and the stories that we heard, I never read his paperwork, but I mean, he was straight. He took like 2x4s and like, I don't know how he like had women like on like, what is it? Fucking plywood somehow. And they found these plywood kind of, I don't know, like stretcher kind of things that he made against the wall. And he apparently had women like shackled onto that in his basement or cellar or fucking dungeon, as it were.
Jesus.
And so there was several different types of blood that was found on these things. And somehow there was 2x4s that I remember were the evidence, like the nail in the coffin that had this guy basically going away forever. And he ended up, you know, being a white guy. Somehow he ended up on, you know, the same table, like sharing meals at the same table that I was in, because I was in Pod C down here in Oakland, 4th and Broadway, I think. That's where they held the feds and the giant crack cases, you know, with pounds of coke and kilos of fucking heroin and meth and stuff. So I did jump ahead big time.
That's okay.
But on that whole Pruno excursion. So, but again, I got out of my detox when I fucking was put into general population and Marysville. That's when I could get my bail underway because again, I didn't have much contact for that detoxing week. So as soon as I got out into GP, I was seeing my gal. She was showing up. We were visiting daily or as frequent as visiting hours were allowed, especially for a fucking co-defendant, which technically eventually there would be a no contact law or rule against between me and my gal, but again, slipping through hoops and cracks was something that was somewhat paramount in the unraveling of this case and the subsequent incarceration of all of us. But anyway, so I had her on the hot track to get the bail money. It happened. Bail was set. I got out of jail, which was crazy because there was like a federal footnote on the screen. Apparently, this is what I was told, standing there with like two outtake there's always like two or three computer screens and agents or COs before you, when you enter jail and when you exit, because they don't just say, okay, there's the door, see ya, pat you on the back. You have to go through your medical stuff, you have to go through your personal stuff, you have to basically sign, seal, and deliver everything, all your information, your life, get the documents, the fucking time you're going to court, or the time, you know, basically all that stuff. So as I was exiting, I started realizing, how am I even getting out of jail when this isn't even about like guns and drugs? This is about the fucking $198,000 in cash that I'm being allegedly fucking accused of fucking acquiring illicitly through, you know, like crazy means. And I started realizing that the outtake was taking a whole lot longer than previous outtakes the few times I've been in jail, which can take up to like half an hour depending on the business. And I was like standing around for like a half an hour at each computer, and I just noticed like each of the deputies or whatever that were there, they were just reading and reading on the screen and they weren't saying anything, and I was like, this is not right. And I started, by the second window, you know, I was sweating and I was like, I'm not getting out of here, because they're reading the fucking shit. They're reading that this guy's a federal fucking, you know, suspect on a pretty, you know, substantial size pending federal beef. And I lost my hope. And then I get to the third window after it must have been 90 minutes. And I'm like, they are literally going to turn me back and give me my bedding. Cause you know, they call it rolling up when you're getting bounced out of jail or you move to a different cell cause you've snitched in that cell or you have gang affiliation that, you know, or whatever, they roll it up, you know, and then that means you roll up your plastic bedding and all your gear inside the mattress and you know, you put it all in your hands and you take off and go to where you're going. So at this point, when they said roll it up, I hit the fucking, you know, I hit the outtake, and this is like hours. And then finally I get to the final one, literally before I can see the exit doors. And this, by the way, I should know, it was Snohomish County Jail, which is it's in the great city of Everett, Washington, Everett. Yeah, it's almost a fucking spot-on, identical sister city of Eureka, if you can imagine that. Yes, yeah. Wonderful, beautiful, and fairyland-like. So I fit right the fuck in there. So basically, I got to that third window, and it finally is divulged. The guy is hesitant to stamp me and give me my belongings because he's like, what? He literally is, you know, he's confused. He's like, okay, so yeah, you have court date pending this the substance, illicit substance, and these firearms, but there's this whole, I don't know, some kind of a blinking, like, I don't know what it was, but it was clearly a brief synopsis or some little narrative about a federal fucking investigation and a casino and, you know, upwards of 200 at large and all this stuff and my name in it. But yet there was no charge. There was no penal code violated. It was just this thing. And it probably said, like, don't let the guy go, but try to delay him. But there was no one to extradite me. There was no federal guys waiting. So they could not hold me. Although we know, really, they could have, because inside the jail, you know, what am I going to do? I can bang on the doors and walls, but they can ignore, like they've proven to do so many times. Yeah. And think of the, you know, Central Park Five and Mumia Jamal.
Of course.
Jamal. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Geronimo, I mean, all these guys. And it's like people are locked up every day, all day, for years and decades, and they didn't do a damn thing, railroaded. Our great country is, you know, very prolific at taking care of that type of non-offenders. Mm-hmm, anyway, mm-hmm. So somehow, to, you know, wrap this part up, I just start talking, and I don't know how, but I just say, you know, yeah, that thing, that's all been resolved, and fortunately, that's dropped, and I'm not sure why this paragraph is on the computer, but it's clearly clerical error and whatever. I mean, I'm happy to have been bailed out, and I should have already been, you know, at home now, blah, 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 and I don't know, the guy just got either convinced or fed up with my BS and just didn't care enough to call a simple number, which would have been the detective. And again, I don't even know they could have even held me at that point because there was no charge, even though I was clearly their number one suspect. So they buzzed the door. I had my private belongings. I took off. My girl was waiting for me right there. We raced away. I popped a handful of fucking Vicodin that she had gratuitously procured, and I went and jumped in a bath of some hotel and got to, you know, explain everything. And then we started, at that time, we started realizing, all right, so she was on bail. I was on a different type of bail. She was on bail for, it's a little confusing at this point right now, because during this time, there was a lot of Valiums and a lot of Xanax and a lot of Vicodins and Norcos, because we were, and that was one of the biggest mistakes ever, because I was already clean at that point of being in the Snohomish County Jail for 2 weeks.
To get back on it, yeah. Back in the mix, it's not good.
Oh boy, that was a fucking regression of epic proportion.
So, I mean, with all that being said, I mean, like, it's, I have to ask, like, how do you get out of this and not have you know, spend your life behind bars?
Right.
You know, like,
you good know. Question. Pretty simple answer, if there's any simplicity to this tale. I guess real quickly, to touch on the indictment that I was alluding to previously. When I got the indictment, when I was transferred from Snohomish County Jail, directly transported in shackles through Oregon, through Cali, to Humboldt County Jail.
By bus?
It was by a fucking armed marshal, federal marshal. It's like you've seen, you know, Tommy Lee Jones and shit. Armed marshal in a car, privately driven. But there was another guy with me who also was a fucking heist man. Pretty crazy shit. He was like 65. He was crazy. He was like a Mickey Rourke type of fucker, and just bullheaded and fucking grunting fucking, and he would do shit with like forklifts and ATMs and shit, man. Excavate entire fucking building walls and fucking come out with like fucking just man, that stories I heard.
Well, that sounds like we could go on a whole other crazy tangent.
Yeah.
So good. To avoid the
major,
let's stick to your story.
Yeah, exactly.
That guy sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, no, we'll be, it's really a blessing that I meet these guys like after I'm retired, because the shit that would have happened if I had hooked up with any kind of a crew. So I got that indictment. After I bailed out, I ran around for a couple of weeks and was going to face the arraignment, you know, when I got out of... and so I was, at that point, I had a choice. I either surrender because I was going to face the drug and gun, but I knew what was going to happen. As soon as I got to court and walked into court, because I was on bail, they were basically going to, the feds would be sitting there waiting for me because they're wondering what happened. Was there was a fucking a newspaper article happened after I bailed out of Marysville. That's when shit hit the fan and the feds went fucking ape shit. They're like, what do you fucking mean he's fucking free?
Sure.
He's in jail. And they're like, well, he fucking had a goddamn little petty ass, you know, drugs and guns, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
And they put a newspaper article. That first time we heard it, me and my girl went to a Chinese restaurant, you know, wandering around in Seattle, and we read ourselves on the Examiner in San Francisco. Remember, we're up fucking like 50 miles from Canada.
Yeah.
Thinking about our next move. And there it is. We read ourselves. We see our pictures, and they're like, fugitive fucking blah, blah. Third suspect is on the loose. Don't know how he got out of fucking jail, but he's free, and we're on the lookout. It's a BOL for blah, blah, this guy, Pete. And so then I realized, shit, okay, well, it did seem a little simpler
than I
thought.
What's a BOL? I'm sorry.
Be on the lookout.
Okay.
Like an APB.
Of course. Yes, of course.
It's all right. So the trick is, that was like a three-state, and I won't say it was a manhunt, but I will say this. When I call my closest friends, my family members, all the people in whatever circles that I thought that I had up till that point, which is, you know, it's a fair amount of humans, you know. I did not get a pickup. I got people picking up and saying, who is this? I don't know you, click. Wow. I mean, I would try contacting my closest confidants only to hear them say, dude, you fucked up, man. I can't help. Click. And then I was able to learn later through, you know, a few face-to-faces, like from closest family members, dude, they'd say, dude, you got to fucking get out of here. There's been a fucking Crown Vic parked in front of our house for like 2 weeks now.
Oh, my God.
You have fucking shit the bed. You've screwed the pooch. Get the fuck out of here and don't, you sort your shit out, mate. They were like, dude. And this happened several times. And then I was able to, and then I was doing some fucking pills. Like I had a Hell's Angels friend that I was shacking up with in a shack, literally. Of course, he eventually, like, you know, stole the cars when I was locked up later for those 11 months or for the year in Oakland. He went made off with my Camaro LT1. He made off with my fucking Jeep Laredo because he was my mechanic. So he was like overseeing some stuff of mine when I was locked up. But when I got out, nowhere to be found. Anyway.
Wow.
Yeah. Friends that aren't friends.
Yeah.
Basically, I had the choice, and I realized when I read the indictment, when I finally, okay, I surrendered. That's where it gets to, you know, getting down to brass tacks and how this all resolves, because I can go on and on about the side stories and all the tales and all the fucking days and the events and, you know, that's day to day in this life. So, I realized that I didn't have anyone to turn to. After all these doors slamming in my face, my girl had surrendered at that point. We had to part each other's ways in Seattle because she was on that bail, and yet her arraignment happened, and so she had to face the judge all the way down in the Northern District of San Francisco for the federal, you know, crimes. She had to face them, and then she had the help of her folks to bail her out. And that's where a $200,000 bail comes into play, or whatever it was. And so her folks put up the house.
Right.
My other homie, you know, he had already been implicated, then subsequently arrested and indicted. And I didn't know the details, but I know that he had some fam that, or I think his soon-to-be wife helped bail him out. So basically the newspaper articles that were coming out quite consistently in the time there between were saying, okay, we have two of the suspects, we're going to get ready for trial, but we can't go to trial without the fucking third man, the masked man, the security guard, i.e. yours truly. So I had, the pressure was on. I was thinking, am I going to go to fucking Canada? Am I going to go to fucking Mexico? I'm so close to Canada. I literally at points I was like 15, 20 miles from there. I don't know how far Marysville where I was shacked up at, but, I was staying in that northern part of Seattle.
Yeah.
And again, cloudy judgment. I had started jumping back on the pills and stuff. Although not as heavy, I was still so fucking clouded and mixed up and discombobulated from all the events. I didn't know what to do. I thought, I'm pretty sure it was a big event. I didn't know if they were going to tie in the drugs and the guns, which are enhanced situations. So I didn't know if I was, like you said, life away. And, you know, no one got hurt, but again, the threat of violence during a commission of a robbery or said burglary, that's just bad news. Anyone knows that. I'm thinking, what, 10 to fucking 25 or something? And that will make anyone consider, you know, flight.
Sure, sure.
Because fighting doesn't seem to be an option. Anyway... Okay, I decide to fucking, I run out of pills again. I get down to Humboldt County on my own. I take a Greyhound. I'm fucking paranoid. I'm thinking that there's, after I hear that the feds are basically door to door through three states, any fucking humans I know, I decide it's on. I want to surrender on my own terms. I don't want to get caught up in another county jail. I don't want to get caught up halfway between here and San Francisco, meaning Marysville and Seattle.
Yeah.
So, I surrender down in Humboldt County is what I do. And that's where I meet up with, you know, a few friends that kind of shack me up. And one friend came and gave me some money, a friend of the show, gave me a heater and a fucking blanket, a sleeping bag when I was literally in a shack. So I'm grateful for the few friends that actually reached out or actually received my call. So there are friends that, you know, really count in a time like this, no matter what the fucking circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
And non-judgmental people in your corner is a huge thing, because it wasn't like I'm a fucking mad criminal that's out to get the world and fuck everyone over. I was fucked up. I was on drugs. I was cloudy. I'd had some criminal things in the past in life, but it's all on the road to survival. Living on the street in Oakland as a child, I was forced to survive. That translates into later life stuff. You have old habits. Mm-hmm. And you have routines that you rely on. Times get tough, and there it is. I became addicted a few times, and that turns into desperation. So I found myself in a desperate situation now, which was get the hell, face this shit, because you're not going to be on the run, and I didn't want my two co-defendants fucking getting railroaded for this thing when I'm the one that fucking put them into this shit.
Mm.
They were complicit. I mean, they were very much into it and even motivated the racing, the expediting of the execution of this gig, but I'm the one that like put them in the positions and basically taught them, you know, and you know, planned it all. So I thought I gotta face the music. I wasn't worried about them finking or snitching or whatever, because it didn't matter. I was already free. And if I'm on the run, I'm gonna be invisible. So I decide, fuck it, face the music. I go and I surrender myself in Humboldt County, and then that's from there is when I got transported with the crazy ATM fucking bandit, and then they take us down to Santa Rita here, Alameda County Jail, because that's the closest to San Francisco Northern District Federal. I'm in Santa Rita for a while, a couple of months waiting, and I got indicted up in Humboldt County. That's where the 55 years came into play, when I read the five different charges, ranging from money laundering to crossing state lines with $10,000, stolen money used to purchase, you know, over $10,000, yada, yada, yada. And so when I saw that I had 55 years, that's what threw me into a tailspin of fight or flight. And I seriously considered, you know, flight. Anyway,
chose the alternative, right?
Exactly, because at this point in my life, I'm like, dude, this is ridiculous. I fucked up major, fucked up royally. I've gotten by in life so many times and been implicated, and I beat cases. I've gotten things expunged. I've been smart, and I've been luckier than shit, but at this point, I felt my luck ran out, and I think it was due to the drugs, and that was a realization I had to make, and basically commit to, like, I need help. I was fucked up, and so I'm willing to pay whatever consequence. That's it. So, because I was tired. I was tired of being fucked up. I was tired of running.
Sure.
I was tired of being alienated by my own loved ones. That was the worst part.
That's
of
gotta
it.
Gotta be so heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was like a lonely solitude that is as bad as anything, really.
But that's gotta come with committing any kind of large scale crime. That's what it is. Like, that's what I'm hoping when people listen to this, like, if they may have that option, like, that's a given, is alienating people, becoming isolated, running out of resources very, very quickly, you know, and having to make desperate decisions. Yeah. And, you know, like, it's, I got to give it to you. I mean, while I don't condone what you did, like, I mean, I do, I'm glad that, like, you were able to kind of take your case in your hands and somehow make it work for you, right?
Well, yeah, and thanks. I appreciate that, too. That's why I've always considered you a good friend, because I think we have a lot of understanding, and we have a lot of similarities as far as creativity, and we've had a lot of history, and mm-hmm. I'm glad you're giving me this opportunity, because as you probably stated on maybe the first part of this thing, I haven't gotten to, you know, quote unquote, state my case. I haven't told the story. I mean, I've told it to my friends and, you know, some family, because they deserve to know what's going on. And I don't, there's no ego in this anymore. It's, I had to humble myself and walk myself into a police station and basically give up potentially for years and years. And this is where I got so fucking lucky, because doing that, I surrendered and I had to say I need help as far as the system and drug-wise. I needed social and emotional help. I needed guidance. I needed things that I was just too proud and too fucking ego-centered to even acknowledge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what's gotten me in trouble in my life and bad decisions. But it was a time when I realized there was people on the line now that were taking the rap for something that it was my fucking brainchild, for lack of a better term. So, I end up getting put into the federal, as I was talking earlier about the federal lockdown for the East Bay, not Santa Rita. Santa Rita is the county jail, one of the worst in the entire country. It's been on fucking lockdown. You know, TV, cable networks have had that place. I've seen multiple people that I've been incarcerated with, cellmates with, pod buddies, they've been on there. I'm quite glad, frankly, that I didn't see my ugly mug on that fucking show, because it's bad enough the amount of infamy that comes from the media and the hype and the bullshit that I had to, you know, that I didn't suffer, that I had to endure, that I had to face, because everything that came from this situation I deserved, and probably even more. But I have paid dearly and sacrificed immensely, to your point about family and loss and trust and just reputation. I mean, as someone that doesn't fancy myself an educator, I have educated people, and I've been a mentor and a counselor, to, you know, thousands of kids. And my goal before any of this stuff, before any drugs, before even college, I always thought I really loved, like, you know, the hope of things being better in the world. And so that's why I became a teacher. That's why I was a camp counselor for several summers. And, mm-hmm. and so all that to say, I realize I'm a pathetic, pointless idiot that was out for his own fun and party. And granted, I was a musician and I had great messages that I feel I was expressing creatively. I also, in the last legs of my solo endeavors career, I was also falling and regressing into subject matter that was not characteristic of me, like the girls and the drugs and the guns and the parties and the fucking cliche ass bullshit that pretty much is running fucking rampant on all the airwaves and the videos and the fucking mumbling bullshit that is somehow described or defined as hip hop, which mm-hmm. I'm baffled. I'm dumbfounded by what garbage is, you know, plaguing the generation. So, bottom line, I needed to turn. I turned the corner, and I faced it, and I fought that fucking case, you know, for the next 12 months. What I knew is they had enough evidence, and although I say the whole manufacturing and this and that of evidence and you know, kind of twisting things into what story they needed to convict me, the bottom line is I was guilty.
Yeah.
And I knew I was. And I was playing the fucking game, and they even thought there was a fourth member in this crew that I always had. I was the one manufacturing different stages and making them think there was a different getaway driver and a different masked man. I had them thinking that I was a fucking driver and that there was the guy that was in the video, all the security fucking, the security guard, the false one, they thought maybe that was a different guy. And I had, you know, my own lawyer thinking that. So again, the whole time I was playing stuff, but really that was strategy that I was using to, you know, bolster my case to maybe get free. But in the end, I had to cop to it because I wasn't going to go to trial. I knew that I didn't have a chance because I just felt it and I could have fought it. And a damn good chance. If I had fought it, we know what would have happened. I would have gone to jail for several years. There was like, I think there was like, if I went to trial, it seemed like the whisper was like a mandatory minimum of like 5 years. And that's still kind of conservative.
Yeah.
The guidelines, which are the federal guidelines for sentencing, are this in a nutshell. It's a graph and it's just like any graph you see where across the, you know, horizontal line on the top, it starts with, you know, your type of crimes and your past history. So basically the first box is, you know, no felonies ever, which I happen to fall in that first section, that first cube. Uh-huh. And then the second one is like, okay, a couple felonies. The third one's like mini felonies and yeah, so on and so forth down the line. And then the boxes on the graph that are vertical from top to bottom, that is severity of federal offense. So in this case, the first cube happened to be under 200, maybe it was 250,000. No, I think it was under $200,000. And so for whatever magnitude the offense was, if it was in this case a robbery or, you know,
yeah.
So I again fell under the minimal, and then the next box down, of course, the second tier was, of course, you know, $500,000. Then it goes to $1 million in the third box, then 10 million, 20, and then $1 billion. So, you know, like white collar crime and these Ponzi schemes, these fucking trust fund, crazy heists, mm-hmm. and you know, that shit, that those are the ones that are the big 20, 30 year locked in federal. So I just,
so you ended up doing how long?
Well, being that I was in the lowest of the guidelines on both my past experience, my past record, which was basically null and void, non-existent, and then under the fucking threshold. So as far as I guess my codies, you know, I did concern about them. I felt a fair amount of responsibility for their well-being and, uh-huh, their future. I mean, my girl, she was freaking a softball star in a few colleges, and you know, she was a fashion aspiring artist, a fashionista, designer, and so I felt, you know, we were in love and we had a great thing going, even though it was kind of, you know, like Requiem for a Dream style. Hey,
yeah. Sounds like it.
Yeah. But so anyway, we all agreed to, even though, yeah, we were all in the same boat, but we actually were going separate because they wanted to try us all together. But there's a whole different thing that goes with that, and we can get railroaded as a group together, kind of once you commit to a group. I mean, but what they want to do, they want to separate you so they can kind of attack each one, play each one against each other.
Right.
But we stayed as a unified, you know, defendant for the whole time, even though we had our separate. I had a lawyer, a court appointed lawyer. My gal had a fucking private lawyer who was a Nimrod, and then my buddy, he had a fucking public defender. So they were all in. You know, they all talked, they all conferred, and sometimes we were not agreeing so much on the game plan. But basically, it came down to, we weren't gonna win, and that was me. I knew we weren't gonna win, and my lawyer was a badass. He used to be a prosecutor. He convinced me too. There was no way to win, and just from history, if you look at it, you can't fucking, right, beat the feds. So I said, I've already been sitting this thing out for a fucking year and almost a year, and I realized like there were opportunities over the course of that year that I could have got bailed out. You know, once things started slowing down and the newspaper articles stopped, yeah, there were opportunities. As the months and months passed, and I was comfy, you know, as comfy as you can be, fighting a case inside, even though that's not prime. You need to be out there in your plain clothes and stuff. But the bottom line is, I was like, well, if this is a year for fucking my crimes, and maybe we can, like, get this on paper as part of a plea bargain. And sure enough, the co-defendants, were cool with it. They realized that fighting it, especially with their counsel, was not going to be conducive to the overall outcome. And we all concurred that plea deals would have to be listened to and entertained. And that's what happened. We all took deals. So we all together went down individually, but as a ship, and which I think was the best case scenario, because I was damn near close to doing time served. I think by the time I signed the deal, I was in jail less than a month after that, because you sign for a year and a day, which means on a year and a day, if you do more than a year, then you'll get good time.
Yeah.
Which people seem to think that the jail or federal doesn't give you good time for good behavior, but that's contrary, because I know I'm a living fucking, example of.
Yeah, because how long did you end up going in for?
I think I did maybe 11 months, I'm thinking, but there was the travel. I'm pretty sure it was like 85% of a year and a day. So, and I have a calendar scrawled out somewhere in some place, which, is fine if I never see it. But, And so then my Cody's had their deals, which my gal, she had this, I think she had the same as me. She got the exact same year and a day, which she did in a federal women's camp here in Dublin. And then she had some bumps and bruises along the way, with drugs, unfortunately, and shoplifting. So she hadn't learned her lesson like many of us do. I had been down this road for so many years. It was time. It was the end of my career, effectively, and still is, fortunately. But thanks. But the guy, he got tagged with a little bit more, because he was, of course, unfortunately, he was tagged the mastermind. And the reason he couldn't escape that designation was because he was caught literally red-handed, hand in the cookie jar. He was the security, head of security at this casino, and therefore he was in a power position. And consequently, as a power position being abused, he gets extra time.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, when he pled, he got a little more time. Not even double the time, but...
Where did he serve, in Humboldt?
I'm not sure. No, not Humboldt. It was a federal. So he basically, they both did okay, because she was in a camp, outdoor free running around, work and stuff. And he was in Club Fed, wherever that was, but he had all the perks and all the goodies of a nice, comfy, and me in the goddamn fucking hardened East Bay, Oakland, downtown. I think they've even shut that place down since, is what I just heard recently. So no tears for that occurrence. So that's in a nutshell. And so since then, I got out, and I voluntarily went into the halfway house, because knowing myself, knowing I had no family and friends and no money, I was broke as shit. I said, I need a place to live that's not on the street right when I get out, because I was going to try and hit the ground running. But the reality is, You can't hit the streets in a sprint if you don't have shoes and a jogging suit. I had nothing.
Right, right.
So I decided to just get into the halfway house there, Turk and Taylor, 111 Turk Street, and work my ass off. I got a job, within a couple weeks, and Joe's Crab Shack, corporate, and I was making real good money with all the tours. I said I wanted to be a server because I needed to get cash quick.
Yeah.
And so I've been, doing that for many, many years. I've been writing music. I've been able to start a couple of bands, I'm doing my art and everything. But yeah, the last 10 years, 10 years plus, has been quite a change in my life, because I've now become that abiding citizen, upstanding, being a retired career criminal, I guess. And a retired teacher, I have a perspective that, often puts my own head into, a tumultuous kind of imbalance.
Yeah, I think you're probably an anomaly in some regards, as far as like some of your fellow inmates. You seem like you're more ingenuitive in some senses. You've always been kind of thinking on your feet. But then again, perhaps there are many other people like that inside.
Yeah, there's, I know I'd have to agree on a big level, although it's fascinating to see what is behind those walls, because far too often it's assumed and the judgments hit and, you know, you get caught with something or you do something and you have a case and you become a criminal, and that's all people see. No one wants to hear what you have to say. No one cares. There's no rehabilitation. Yeah. You're basically just a fucking monster behind bars, whether it's drugs, whether you are a monster, like some of the fucking freaks I unfortunately had to, you know, reside with for nearly a year. But there are some intelligent, very sad cases of other teachers. I've met a few teachers and all the different. Oh, wow. Yeah. And you know, maybe even a professor I've met, but they've also been like a wolf in sheep's clothing. I've seen guys that were, you know, just like, and the big thing I still take away from this is the amount of knowledge that I was able to somehow, you know, foster, accumulate. I learned so much about the system, and it really was heartbreaking to see basically the imbalance of how the system, like, for instance, as we all know, or at least you should know by now, I mean, there's, some black dudes in there that, you know, had like a bag of crack cocaine, literally like 20 or 30 rocks. Okay, wait, that's not even an ounce. Or even if it's an ounce or more, okay, it's a bag of rocks. And then you got some fucking white collar guy, some upstanding, you know, some real well to do, clean shaven, you know, whatever, blonde and light skinned. And he is like moved like to an undercover officer, task force, drug enforcement, DEA. And he sold like a kilo or two of either meth. And I've seen guys that had like 3 kilos of coke. And these fuckers literally had the same sentences and the same penalties as the guys that had a fucking handful of crack rocks. If there's not fucking systematic oppression and like injustice, there's just, and I saw this like over and over.
Well, I don't doubt that.
It's a fucking joke, and it's really what's wrong with our system today. And I've always suspected and seen this and experienced stuff with this growing up in East Oakland. I've seen a lot of this. Yeah, you know, but to see it firsthand and to watch guys going down for 10 years is what I'm saying, for a guy with a bag. And some of these guys were like crackheads. It was literally, they know they weren't like some big kingpins, or if they were, they were just starting out little corner guys. And it's like the system is rigged beyond any fucking capacity of comprehension.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, I appreciate you being as candid with me and the listeners too, because I mean, you know, it's a super personal story. You don't have to share that with people. So, but the fact that can kind of break it down, I mean, the way you describe it to me, it just sounds like, you know, it's more of a cautionary tale than anything. Something that you can totally learn from, you know, that anybody, no matter where you are. And I appreciate that aspect of it. I'm glad that it sort of worked in your favor to a point where you could kind of come out the other end and get work, get a nice place, like kind of get reestablished on your own and not like, get too caught up in the mix, you know.
No, I appreciate that, man, because you recognize and you know me. And like I said earlier, we've had some great experiences and got to know each other personally. And the trick is that, you know, there's people that will see me forever and just look at me like I'm an enemy and I'm the crook and the criminal and the bad guy, the boogeyman, whatever. That's fine, because I know who I am in my skin, and I know I needed help. And it took me many, many years, decades to finally humble myself and swallow the pride enough to say, look, okay, the jig is up. I need to help myself. And if I ever want to do teaching again, who knows what's going to happen with my credentials. And if I want to pursue a master's like my original plan, there's so much. I think, you know, it's a great thing that you can understand your platform here is a great fucking venue for education and a lot of, you know, the edutainment, so to speak, because the cautionary aspect is true. I mean, I'm just a normal everyday freaking schmuck is what I like to say, kind of like Goodfellas and Ray Liotta. At the end, he's like, all I do in this you know, of course he was in witness protection, but he still was, you know, he snitched on everyone, which that's different than me, but he basically gave up the good life of the Kingpin and the Don, and he basically went into, like, I don't know, bumfuck Kansas or whatever it was, and Nowhereville, USA, and and he's like, I'm just eating, you know, marinara here is just ketchup and noodles, and it's like that, you know, he's just like the regular old schmuck, and like, for me, I always thought, what a boring life, how pathetic, and, you know, the 9-to-5s and the cubbies that they work in and the computers, and, you know, and the bottom line is, it's the system, it's the society we're in, and, you know, I had bigger designs and, you know, this and that, but I've had a full life, and I'm just blessed that I'm actually breathing and being, like you said, being able to work. I mean, working at a hard-ass job, and I still only, you know, work, like, sometimes 4 days a week, and I have a 3-day weekend. I mean, that in itself is a blessing. I mean,
when you've been in the hole, then, like, come on. Like,
people have been in, like, you know, they've been working 40, 50, 60 hours a week, and I complain that I still have 4 shifts a week, and I'm making it, I'm okay, and I can save some money and go across to, you know, Puerto Vallarta last month, and, you know, I'm planning to do New Orleans next, you know, season. I mean, I'm blessed, and I'm fortunate that people at least give me, you know, the opportunity and you know, the outlet to at least explain that there's multiple ways out, and it doesn't have to be self-destructive, and it doesn't have to be against, it doesn't have to be against the grain. You don't have to be like living the Wild West, to, you know, get some adrenaline going and some excitement. You can do bungee jumping, you can do ropes courses, and you can do parachuting. I mean, there's a lot of like wild activities that maybe I should have contemplated before, maybe, you know, pulling, you know, bigger fucking licks and
right.
Yeah. So yeah, man.
But you live and you learn, right?
Yeah, exactly. Live and learn every day. So yeah, it's an experience, but yeah, man, I appreciate it. It's always fun talking with you, man, whether the tape's on or not.
Yeah, always, dude. Right. Much on. Love, and let's do it again next time when you got a project or something. Absolutely. Now we got this out of the way.
Yeah, exactly. You know? No, it's on to the creative juices next, and any collabos. It's going to be nice, man. Good talking.
Hell yeah.
Hey, diggers, this is an announcement. Episode 18 is on the way. We are in the final polish. All the bodywork, sanding, and the paint has been put on this rocket ship, so we just need that final coat to finish. Coming out of the last few episodes of the Rock and Roll Archaeology podcast that concentrated on specific geographies like London, LA, San Francisco, and New York, we are now in the home stretch of our time in the 1960s. And so with this one, it's not about a place on a map, but a year in the life. It's called Episode 18, 1969, and it's a year so big in rock and roll, it'll take 2 episodes to tell the full tale. Part 1 will cover mostly the first half of the year. We'll spend most of our time in the UK checking in with the Beatles as they are beginning to fray internally, while friends and competitors, the Rolling Stones, are about to become the greatest rock and roll band in the world. Of course, the Fab Four are still able to be the Beatles, so therefore they are not going down without a fight. And the Glimmer Twins must make a sacrifice to achieve the greatness of that 68-73 run of peak Stones. Then we go beyond England and America and venture into outer space, where we dissect the moonshot and how it affected society and the arts. So, like the sci-fi that surrounds the very real human endeavor, we will peek into the future ourselves with some rock and rollers that will really take us into the next decade. So hold tight, it won't be long now. It's coming, and we think you will all be pleased. Episode 18, 1969, Part 1. Tell a friend.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.